Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. With us, Dominic Constum. I know David's got a series of questions for you, but Dominic, let me talk about sterling at 126. Does Prime Minister May want a weak sterling or a strong sterling, or is she oblivious to it?
Well, I think the sort of immediate issue is to have a good trade deal with Europe. That's the biggest concern. And obviously, there's been a lot of concern in the financial sector in terms of banks moving some kind of operations potentially out of the UK on a bad deal with Europe. And I think the way to think about the currency is that if you think there's a better chance you'll get a good deal, sterling doesn't need to be so weak. The calls that we ever have as a house had and have had of very weak sterling reflects a concern that the UK would struggle to get a decent deal, perhaps, and on that basis would go for a weaker currency. So I don't think there's anything sacrosanct about, you know, where we want sterling or where the British want sterling. I think it's an issue of what kind of trade deal are they going to have, and they definitely want a special deal with Europe that highlights the integration of the UK economy with the rest of Europe.
Just a moment ago, our colleague Ed Ludlow was describing the complicated electoral landscape. This adds a further complication to it. For investors, how much does this matter, having this election here on June the 8th?
Well, I think for the UK, it matters a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, there's also this other element, which I don't think is going to get a lot of play, but without question, people are going to play it. And for the opposition parties, if they can make real inroads against the Tories, despite the polls, then clearly there's going to be an argument that this could be a second referendum, if you like, on the whole Brexit stuff. That's obviously, to some extent, what they're going to try. Remember, the complaint on the referendum itself was that a lot of the Labour Party didn't turn up, and they just thought this was not going to happen. And then afterwards, people really question whether the British really understood what they were doing. So this is going to be a way of just making that, clarifying that. So it's very important. For the rest of the world, obviously, matters much less. I think France is much more important for Europe.
Yeah, well, let me ask you about that. Looking at your most recent note here, you said the risks are, they appear to be mispriced. What do you mean by that? And sort of, what's your sense of what will happen here?
Well, I think there's people, when they look at the second round intentions, there's such a wide gap between Le Pen and Macron or Fillon that people assume it's kind of not important. I think the issue is what does say Le Pen have to do in the first round to make you be a bit more worried about it, given the way that previous polls have gone, both in the States and the Brexit, for example. So from that perspective, the pricing in the volatility markets was between, say, 5% and 10% in both rates and FX was a sort of general view. And the idea is that that's probably a bit too low. Although, given the way recent polls have gone, you know, maybe it shouldn't be, you know, as high, say, you know, sort of 40-60 or something. So I think the question you should ask yourself is, what does Le Pen have to get in the first round for you to reprice those risks in the 2 weeks before the second round? And in our view, you know, anything like that, you know, high 20s and definitely something like 30% would be a big concern, because it would get you in the sort of margin of polling error. But for now, it's been such an open election now, and she's obviously slipped, and Fillon's done a bit better, very volatile. But remember, a lot of people are still undecided. I think the last poll I saw was like a third of the electorate is still undecided. So, you know, it's going to be interesting.
How does one, and I suppose I'm being coy there by saying how does one, how do you position yourself ahead of this election, given all of the risk?
Well, the good news is that given various other things going on, including the disappointment in the States on tax reform, some of the data, which hasn't been so good on the consumer side. We've got some various forward-looking indicators that make us a little concerned about the economic outlook. You can just be long rates, because this is a bit of a risk-off trade. And the S&P is quite elevated in our view. We think the cheapening recently has been warranted, and I think it's too early to sort of not have a risk risk-off trade.
How about this? In our next section, we'll actually talk about your research. That would be odd thing. Yeah. Is the curve flattening that we're seeing associated with the president of the United States, or are there other things going on?
Well, the big curve flattening was mainly associated with optimism around economic policies post-election in the States and the Fed being able to push on with their normalization. And I don't think people really took a different view in terms of where the terminal funds rate is going to be. So people didn't suddenly say, oh, my God, I thought it was 2-3 and now it's going to be 4-5. They took a view, it's still 2-3, but the Fed can go a bit more quickly because of things going in the right direction in the States. So what you've seen, ever so slightly, is an attempt to sort of unwind some of that flattening.
Dominic Constant with us with Deutsche Bank, and he's been a saint today about speaking of United Kingdom, the ramifications to Prime Minister May of the announced June 8 general election. Right now to your research notes. Help me with where Chair Yellen is May 3rd. Is the real surprise of this second quarter?
Is this May 3rd meeting
is important?
I mean, it could be important if things go very badly in terms of risk assets. So obviously recently risk assets have been under a bit of pressure, gold's going up. You could imagine a scenario where the French elections are a shock and the Le Pen does very well and markets go into a bit of a tailspin. And she could, try and in that sense, she could be a surprise from where we are now. But otherwise, it's too soon for her to do anything, I'd say, meaningfully different from what the Fed has been laying out.
How much has changed since the last meeting, the last rate increase? She looks around at her neighbors in Washington and strikes me that not a whole lot has happened. A lot of these promises have not come to fruition. How concerned is she? How concerned are her? Is the complement of colleagues there on the FOMC about that?
Well, it's interesting because I definitely feel that they did more than they might have otherwise intended to do had the election outcome not been the same. And so they've definitely sort of been a front running. And to some extent, they tried to play that down early on after the election, saying, they did obviously talk about fiscal stimulus, full employment, and that may be a reason to go a bit quicker. But obviously we've had nothing. So from that perspective, there is a danger that they're ahead of the game. And in the end, they sort of undermine some of the sort of feel good about the economy and the equity market if they keep pursuing.
As they look at their forecasts, are you looking at yours as well? Are you revising them in any fashion because of what's happening or not happening in Washington?
Well, after the election, before the election, we were sort of mildly bearish, and on rates, i.e., expecting higher rates and a stronger economy. And then basically after the election, we reinforced that quite aggressively, and we had the idea that 10-year yields might go to 3% and higher. And to be honest, because there's nothing has happened, we've had to bring our forecasts down. So we are much more conservative now in terms of how high rates can go. And in addition to that, because the Fed has been a bit more aggressive than we might have expected, and some of our forward-looking indicators on growth are not so good, I can fully understand this tactical rally that's taking place on rates, where you're forcing out the short positions that are there. We think 10s near-term can probably go down to close to 2%. Obviously, we assume France isn't going to be a disaster, but there's no mistake. I mean, if France goes the wrong way, it is a disaster. So there's a small risk of a terrible event.
A question for Global Wall Street. We're honored, folks, that you listen to us every morning. Which spread, full faith and credit U.S., does Dominic Constant watch? I quote the 2s-10s vanilla, the difference in yield between the 10-year and the 2-year. But what is the pro watch? What do you watch?
Well, I kind of like, the 5-year in a way, because it sort of trades around a lot more, because you don't just capture the very near-term sort of rate outlook, but you're obviously capturing to some extent where you might expect terminal funds rate to be. So 5s-10s, 5s-30s,
5s-30s.
Yeah.
This is great, because David Gura, Tony Dwyer, looks at the 3-month 5-year, which is very different right now than the 2s-10s. It really shows a flattening versus the 2s-10s. What is the 5-10? I've never looked at it. I'm going to do that right now. What is the fact I'm going to look at?
Well, it's sort of, I mean, you're sort of assuming 10s, 30s is fairly stable. And so 5s, 10s is going to be, for example, sort of capturing some long-term rate, term premium sort of concept. And then the 5-year is sort of, you know, where the Fed is sort of going more or less sort of thing over a sort of full cycle. And obviously something like 2 × 10⁻⁵ gives you a 5-year 5-year. And that's really interesting because 5-year 5-year is quite volatile. So that's a 5-year rate 5 years forward. If you look historically, when you finish a tightening cycle, 5-year 5-year is pretty much, you know, sort of on top of, if not through, because perhaps they've overdone it a bit. That's ranged, by the way, from anywhere sub 2 to as high as, you know, you know, 4.5, almost 4¾ in the last couple of years.
So. Do you realize a guy in Route 24 in Massachusetts just drove off the road? There were so many numbers.
He's updating his launch pad. He's updating the monitor.
He was near the Dunkin' Donuts there, right by the... You come north from John Silvius Fall River and there's a Dunkin' Donuts. There's a car off the road on Route 24. There was enough jargon in there, David, to keep us all going.
Oh, my gosh.
The podcast will
be that 1 minute.
We're running out of time. Thank God, with Dominic Custom. There you are in Spreadsheets. I'm going to put the 5-year 10-year out on Twitter just to shake things up this morning. Worldwide with jargon with Dominic Constum. Right now, the warm body in the room is John Stolfus of Oppenheimer and a company. As we look at Goldman Sachs and Bank of America earlier today, what is the belief on the financial sector right now?
Well, we've got to think that what's coming in, we've seen some improvement in terms of the NIMs, the net interest margin spread, in what's being reported, a little bit better than expected. We'd have to think that if we get some recovery in terms of the progress of normalization of interest rates, that'll even get better moving forward in the quarter. But right now, of course, all that progress that we saw for the first quarter may be taken back with interest rates falling again.
When you look at these bank earnings, are you seeing the formation here of a broader theme for first quarter earnings, or is this something sort of germane only to these banks?
Well, I think if there is something among the banks right now, it's that bond trading has picked up significantly, and I think that probably reflects some of the changes we're just seeing in anticipation by investors, portfolio managers, considering what's coming up ahead. I think the Fed remains committed to the process of normalization. It's a needed process. If the administration ever gets to do some fiscal stimulus, we'll be on the way there, and that will be further healing, less pressure on the Fed to hold up the economy.
Give us the John Stolfus outlook for the first quarter earnings season more generally. Are you optimistic here that we're going to get good reads?
Yeah, you know me, David. I'm still optimistic, still bullish. Right, been ever. Bullish since 2009.
Yes.
It's like a hardened bull.
Are you as lonely as you were, or do you see people coming around?
That's one thing that does concern me is I see more people moving to our side of the boat all the time as we move forward. But there's still enough healthy skepticism to make us feel pretty comfortable. But we think, you know, the good possibility we'll see earnings growth of around 9% overall. Yeah. For the S&P 500?
I was off for a week last week.
Good for you.
It's the first time since 2003.
Yeah.
And, you know, I took a vacation. I went to Brooklyn. And, you know, I'm having a kale juice over there at a place that David Gura mentioned. And somebody said to me, how do you justify consumer stock multiples that are nifty 50-like? Explain to, you know, our global Wall Street audience and those mere mortal, how do you buy something that's trading at 27 times earnings?
I think what it is, Tom, is that it is the post-Bernanke reign is essentially we're still in an environment where everything is relative, and relative valuation tells you that the bond market is very little competition to stocks. I think after almost 9 years of the process of a bull recovery market, many people who had stayed on the sidelines are finally looking at the rule of 72. You look at your return. If you got a 1% return, you divide it into 72. It'll take you 72 years to double your money. The effect of that means if you have any kind of objectives, perhaps you should be looking at stocks if you haven't yet. I don't think we've got froth here. I don't think we've got really significant animal spirits. I remember the tech bubble too well. Mm. And that in comparison, there's no comparison for me, at least at this point. So we'd have to think you pay a little bit more in multiple. The average 12-month trailing multiple for the S&P 500 all the way back to the end of 1965 at 16.3 times. Current trailing multiple, as I recall, is around 21 times. So that looks high. But the average yield of the 10-year Treasury all the way back to 1965 is about 6.4%. Versus last I looked, I think we were 2.2%.
David, can we rip up the script?
Yeah, shred it. Shred it if you want to.
Bruce Langhorne just passed away. You don't know who he is, folks, but he died at age 78. A wonderful life, and was one of the great folk musicians out there. He worked with Bob Dylan a million years ago, and John Stolfus with us with Opco. John, he was Mr. Tambourine Man. Wow. You and I were just talking about Roger McGuinn, and the Byrds took Tambourine Man and gave Bob Dylan his first paycheck.
Yeah, they sure did.
But that was the scene back then.
Oh, yeah.
Within the acoustic music that you and I were talking about, there.
Most certainly, I can remember seeing the Byrds way back in the mid '70s in Central Park when they were in full regalia. I mean, they had it was white with the Telecaster with the string bender on it.
David Crosby was a skinny guy at that time.
That's right.
That's very good.
Yeah. Well, it was a very soulful period.
Good morning to Roger McGuinn, if you're listening. I believe down in Florida. Anyways, we digress here. Let's get back to the equity markets here. The fact is Dow 20,600, there is resiliency to equities. What's the why of the resiliency to equities right now?
Tom, I think it's the functionality of equities, the potential for dividend income, total return with potential for capital appreciation in a world in which it looks like inflation will be kept in check by things like robotics on the factory floor, algorithms in the offices, the process of globalization and technology continuing to develop, creating added competition. And so I think people are looking, if they have objectives in their lives, whether it's to leave more money to their favorite university or to their children or to provide for a retirement, the functionality of equities will likely cause people, in this near term, they're already doing it, paying more for each dollar of earnings. It's sort of like, you know, for us who remember the real estate market in New York in 1978, you could buy an attractive a penthouse apartment in Midtown New York for $78,000 that today would be worth probably $6 to $12 million. And that is a function of demand. I'm not suggesting we go to multiples like we had in the tech bubble, but perhaps living with a trailing 12 multiple of around 21 to 23, 24 may be a reality for a while here while rates stay so low.
Yeah. Well, David, jump in. Do you realize we had Professor Gura on yesterday?
I actually heard him. I heard your dad.
Do you know he wrote the definitive book on Martin guitars?
I had no idea.
He wrote, David, so it was the history of that company. I remember very well, I was a kid, we were on a road trip, and we stopped in Nazareth, Pennsylvania, and they said, we've got all these records, Professor Kirk, come and take a look. They opened up a big vault, and literally every record book from the founding of that company was in there. So it's actually a very cool business book because of the... Yeah. You know, the registry that they had, all the wood that he bought, all the parts that he
David,
bought and made.
David, John Stolfus and I don't care. Did your father get a D-45?
He has a 0018. 0018 is his
very sweet guitar, 0018.
We're digressing here with John Stolfus. Get back
to equities. Let me pull us back to these Goldman earnings, and maybe we can use that as a pivot point here. They're citing political uncertainty as a big problem when you look at equities trading, when you look at FIC trading. A comment from that report is, despite global equity prices generally increasing during the quarter, equities also operate in an environment characterized by political uncertainty, low levels of volatility, and low client activity levels. Help us with the volatility component of that first.
Well, the big thing with the volatility is the VIX has been remarkably low. I think last week we had about a 24% upward spike in the thing, but still it's way off the 2015, 2016 highs that we saw in the VIX. And I think a lot of that is that the market itself which in its own collective, I wouldn't say collective wisdom, but in its collective assertion, is really looking at greater opportunity than risk here. And that is because we are in a period, it would appear to us, of overall expansion, not just the functionality of equities, but a global recovery, a U.S. economic expansion that appears quite sustainable at these levels, with an opportunity to get a further boost at some later date from all this fiscal stimulus potential from whether it's infrastructure spending or repatriation of foreign profits by U.S. multinationals, reduced regulation. If Washington can ever manage to bridge the aisle and work together, we might even see even more positives coming across. But all the work that the Fed has done, we believe so far, has paid off, and the next step really falls to fiscal stimulus. Yeah.
This has been wonderful. John Stolfus, thank you so much. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. Joining us now, someone who is so much in the news of the politics of the United States, Anthony Scaramucci, of course, working with the Trump administration. I've got to get to the question everybody that's a supporter of the president in around Republican politics, have you been offered a further position from the White House and from the president?
So my status is still unchanged, Tom. I'm about 5 or 6 weeks away from closing my deal with H&A,
your transaction with the
transaction,
Chinese group,
right? Exactly. And so I've had several meetings inside the White House and several conversations with Jared and Reince Priebus, right, our chief of staff, as well as Steve Bannon. And so, again, I don't want to sound overconfident, but I do think that there's a number of roles that need to be filled, and I think I can fill one of those roles shortly.
Okay, I want to go serious here. Do you watch Saturday Night Live?
I do, yeah.
Okay, you watch Saturday Night Live. Yep. It's a joke. I get it.
I do watch it on Sunday mornings.
That's
so
okay.
Make a confession.
I do the same thing. Everybody laughs about it, except this isn't funny. Are we seeing a more stable White House where we get away from the skits that we see on Saturday Night Live?
Way more stable than the external optics look. In fact, what tends to happen now, because we have so much media, so many cable stations, so many people piling into the press pool, that stories have to be generated. And so I think you'll find that the group is way more stable. I think Jared and Steve get along way better than people want to suggest that they do. Not saying that people are not scrumming with each other from time to time. How could they not in a super intense environment?
I'm reading a book on FDR right now. David Gura, I'm sorry. They were doing it back in the when we were fighting a serious
Which book
war.
Are you reading, Tom?
Larrabee.
Yeah,
Stravitas said, just shut up and read this book, and I'm reading it. It was either that or the history of North Carolina State football.
Listen
I didn't
to
know
the
which
Admiral.
Way to go. Straight David, jump in here State with football. Mr. Scaramucci.
Anthony, help me with who's running the economic show within this White House. Now, you have Kevin Hassett named ahead the CEO. You've got Gary Cohn, of course, mm-hmm. as well. Stephen Mnuchin. A lot of big names, a lot of big personalities. Who's really at the front and center for that agenda?
Well, listen, the president is at the front and center. I think everybody has to recognize at the end of the day, he's going to drive the economic agenda. He has a great sense for where he wants to take the tax code. I don't think you see the infighting there. In fact, I worked at Goldman Sachs with both Gary and Steven. These are very collegial guys. These guys know how to get along with each other and to coordinate policy. And so my guess is that that's going to go better than people expect as well. If you want to think about the taxes for a second and just go back to the health care, I think Steven was very honest.
That worked out.
Secretary of Treasury Mnuchin was very honest yesterday. We sort of have to figure out what's going on the healthcare side before you can really get the full tax reform in place. And so it's going to take a little bit longer than people thought. But is that surprising to anybody in this room? People in this radio room know that these things take a long period of time.
Yeah.
It's 18 months to get Obamacare in place.
Seriously, Anthony, does the president know that? I mean, he's learning about the timeline of the political world, right? I mean, you bought Mike Piazza's jersey. You know the timeline of the New York Mets. It's forever, right?
Yeah, that jersey safely ensconced at the 9/11 Museum now forever.
Do you see a presidential patience developing of the realities of the Washington timeline?
Well, here's one of the things I really love about the president. I don't think he likes the reality of Washington. I don't think he likes the sclerosis of Washington. And so he's a disruptive entrepreneur. He's a change agent. I think people elected him to be a change agent. And so I don't think you want him in the stasis of Washington. I think you want him still rumbling through the China shop a little bit and shaking things up. So yes, he's making some adaptation. I think he's working very well. Here's another breaking news story. I think his partnership with Paul Ryan is way better than people suggest. I think they're working feverishly behind the scenes up on the Hill to get the coalition together to repeal and replace Obamacare.
David, ask a smarter question.
How much does that disruptiveness make him difficult to work for? We were just talking about the statement on the phone call he made to the Turkish president yesterday and how different that was from the statement we got from the Secretary of State, from the State Department. The State Department highlighting the fact that there were irregularities with that election. The president in his statement congratulating him on that referendum vote. I imagine that it could be difficult to work to somebody who might be doing something opposite from what you're doing.
Well, listen, I mean, this has been the hallmark of the president's success. And so I spent 15 months with him on the campaign. He is a guy that will call plays, David, from the line of scrimmage. He's a guy that's his own offensive coordinator as well as defensive coordinator. So if you're not ready to adapt yourself to him and go with the flow with him, if he wants to release his tax returns, guess what he's going to do?
Okay.
He'll release them. Is he going to want to release them?
He's not going
to. Okay, Dennis Gartman, jump in with a question.
He may surprise everybody and do it later on in the year. We don't know.
We got to write your newsletter for tomorrow. Jump in with a question for Mr. Scaramucci.
My biggest question during the entire campaign and thus far in the presidency is the president's propensity to act towards some sort of trade protectionism. Is that going out the door? Has that changed at all, Anthony?
Well, our Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, said over the weekend that all this protectionism nonsense just isn't true. All the president has called for, Dennis, is an equalization of these trade deals. I don't want to take you through 70 years of trade history since the war, but we uneven these trade deals so that we could create burgeoning middle classes around the world. That was very successful. It's led to less violence, more economic interdependence, but it's hollowed out the working class families in the United States. All the president is saying is, let's true these up. Let's make them more fair. I don't think he's looking for protectionism, nor is the Secretary of Commerce.
Where are you going to be ambassador? If they give you a job as an ambassador, will you accept it? Which nation would you like to go to?
Manhattan.
I'm going to go to Antarctica because we're having a difficult time with the penguins down there, Tom. And we got to get our trade deal
Columbus,
right with them.
The Columbus Blue Jackets
are
not.
You guys know I can sell ice to the Eskimos. That is the best spot for me.
Somebody get a memo to Scaramucci, David. The Eskimos are in Arctic. You're going to be ambassador to the Arctic, and it's melting. Good luck with that. Anthony Scaramucci with us today. Of course, he's looking for closing of a transaction with his Wall Street firm and maybe further employment by the Trump administration. Thank you so much for being with us. It was a great moment for Bloomberg Surveillance and all of Bloomberg Radio. Ken Pruitt and myself ringing the bell of the New York Stock Exchange. I get upset with talking about Ken with Charlie Pellett and all of Bloomberg Radio. And today, as he did in 1903 when they had the first bell of the New York Stock Exchange, Dennis Gartman. Well, Dennis, it's really cool. I mean, you're down there on the ramp and, you go down there and you ring the bell and Kenny Polcari throws something at you.
It was a true piece of work.
Barrage. Why are you ringing the bell of the New York Stock Exchange? Is this because UNC took the Final Four?
You would have to bring that up. You would have to bring that up.
Better him than me.
That's okay. No, it's actually the third anniversary of the two ETFs that I have listed on the New York Stock Exchange, Gold Euro, G-E-U-R, and Gold predicated in Yen, G-Y-E-N. They have lived for 3 years.
Yeah.
And we're celebrating the third-year anniversary.
I made a joke, David Gurrow, that Gartman got two calls in a row right, and they said you get to ring the bell of the exchange. How have you been doing?
Actually, I had one call in a row right.
Okay. How have you been doing at your calls in this crazy stock market?
Actually, I trade only for my own account, so I think that that's important. What I write in my newsletter is what I do, and I'm up 5.9% for the year, so I'm doing okay. Do I get things wrong? Oh, you betcha. Do I get things wrong often? Oh, absolutely. I think the important thing is not to stay wrong, and I try not to stay wrong for a very long period of time. The only thing that will take you out of this business
is getting something wrong and adding to it, doing more of that which is wrong. I have a very simple idiom, which I think makes a lot of sense in investing. Let's do more of the things that have been working. Let's try our best to do less of the things that have not. It's very. If you do that in life, you'll succeed. If you do that in investing, you'll succeed.
Let's talk a bit about the dollar. We didn't get to talk about this with Anthony Scaramucci, but to the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, quoted in the Financial Times yesterday talking about the strength of the dollar. We had the president talking about that last week. What's your sense of the direction of the dollar right now?
I think it's still a bull market for the dollar, but it's clearly you have a discussion going on within the administration that I think the dichotomy of the people there is confusing to the market. It was nice to see Mr. Mnuchin come out and say that a strong dollar is, in fact, in the benefit of the United States in the long run. But then he came right back again a few minutes later and said, what is the long run? And perhaps in the short run, we may have to diminish the value of the dollar. I think they're confused as to what they would like to see the dollar do. I still think it's a bull market for the dollar. I think on balance, you want to be long of it, all things being otherwise equal. But today, for example, the surprise news of a UK election has given a bid to the euro and a bid to sterling, a strong bid. Dollar's gotten very weak in the last 3 or 4 hours. Very interesting.
Let me reprise a question I heard somebody ask Tom yesterday. We do these Facebook Live videos a few days a week, and somebody asked why the yen is such a good safe haven right now if, in fact, it's so close, so proximate to what's going on in North Korea.
I think the only thing that you can say is that because it is proximate to what's going on, it should be contrary. You'd think otherwise. Yeah. You'd think money would leave Japan. But perhaps what's really happening is Mr. and Mrs. Watanabe, because they're fearful about what's going on, are saying, I want my money coming home to me rather than send my money abroad to somebody else. You would think money would leave Japan, but I think the actual rational explanation is money is going home because of fear rather than anything else. Does it make sense? No. Should it go the other way? Yes. Is it going the way of a strong yen for right now? Mm-hmm. Yes, much to my dismay.
The shorts are humbled. I guess we've come down drastically from 21,000, but we just can't get the gloom going.
No.
Why is that? Chair Yellen?
No, I think it's because the business community out in the United States really is feeling better. If you get out of New York, if you go to Virginia Beach...
No, we wouldn't want to do that.
No, need to do that every once in a while.
If you'd have to get a license, it would be...
If you go to Peoria, if you go to Cleveland, if you go to Sacramento, California, there are help wanted signs everywhere. Business is actually doing better at the base, and I think that that's what's going on in the stock market more than anything else. Is it surprising to me? Yes. Do I think share prices are extremely overvalued? Yes. Are price to earnings multiples extended to the upside? Yes.
Then what do you buy within the land of 26 multiples?
You've heard me say this before, and I'll say it again. I'm an old guy. I like old things. I like the simple things that are incumbent in infrastructure and economic growth. Give me steel, which is now back after having fallen almost 30%. I want to own steel this morning. I'm going to buy steel for myself. I want to own ball bearings manufacturers. I want to own cement.
Right.
I want to own simple things.
Within the synthesis of your research note, and folks, it's interesting, page one, if you read it for long enough, there's page one, page two, there's page five and six.
Yeah.
On page five and six is where you talk about the broader, bigger picture.
Yeah.
Does Dennis Gartman believe in a resurgence of the great commodity cycle that we saw starting with China 10 years ago?
I hope. I don't believe
it yet. Hope doesn't count.
Hope has to count every once in a while. I hope. It looks to me like some of the major commodities are trying their best to make lows. It doesn't look like the grain market wants to make
it. You can't bet it right now.
But I'm not going to bet on the long side.
See how he got red corn or winter wheat or whatever the hell he trades in here?
Hard
red winter, the grains.
Hard red winter wheat.
Is that what they use in Budweiser?
No.
I don't even know.
No, they use barley in Budweiser. Hard red winter wheat is what goes into bread. It is the grain that goes into bread.
Okay.
Whereas that's what's traded, used to be in Kansas City. Soft red winter wheat is what goes into cakes. But that's the more dominant futures contract is soft red winter. It doesn't make any sense.
You don't know what goes into Cheez-Its?
No, I have no idea what goes into Cheez-Its, but I can tell you I'm not eating any of it.
David Wilson and I were talking Snyder pretzels yesterday. And I just thought, you know, we could talk Cheez-Its because that's what I feel like right now.
We should come back and talk housing. We're going to get these.
We should talk housing. Yeah, housing with Dennis. It is a famous Gartman phrase. He likes to buy things that if they fall on your foot, they hurt. Maybe is a bell today going to fall on your foot? I mean, there's a.
Now it probably shall.
It shall.
Worse, I'll probably ring the bell and it'll fall on somebody else's foot. You know?
Away from housing starts, we've got industrial production, which is a classic Gartman series.
Yeah.
It's about things that fall on your foot. Why do I care about stagnant industrial production if I'm in a service sector economy?
I'm not sure that you're in a service sector economy for all intents. I mean, we're still building houses. We're still building roads. We'll still build some bridges. We still make some steel. But no question, we are more of a service sector economy than we were 15 years ago. But we're still going to make things. We still need to have cement. We still need ball bearings. We still need steel. we shall for the next 500 years.
You always follow gold. Here's a question about gold. You talk about it in different denominations. You're looking at sort of ones predicated on non-U.S. dollar terms.
Yeah.
Why does that matter? Help me understand sort of the distinction there, what that matters to
people.
Like
need
you.
To understand that when they buy something, if you buy soybeans, you bought beans, you sold dollars. You really have made the predicated bet that the dollar is going to weaken. You'd rather own beans than dollars. If you buy crude oil, you've effectively made a bet against the U.S. dollar. You've really made a bet against the U.S. dollar when you're buying gold. Mm. I mean, supposedly, they are two different currencies. Gold gets priced in dollar terms. I'd rather own gold in currencies that I think are going to fall in value rather than currencies that I think are going to rise in value. There will be a time when I will have no interest in gold in euros. There shall come a time when I'll have no interest in gold in yen. But right now, I do think that the yen's probably going to continue to weaken. The euro's probably going to continue to weaken. And I'd rather own gold in currencies that have been devaluing rather than evaluing.
Naive question. Thank you for answering it. Let me.
No, it's not a naive question at all. We get that question all the time, even from the most sophisticated investors in gold who say, why should I do that? There is a rationale. There is a reason to it.
We were talking at the top of the show about the elections coming up now in the UK. We also have elections in France as well. How are you positioning yourself ahead of the French election?
Frighteningly. It is very confusing because 2 weeks ago, it was almost a given that Mr. Macron was going to be first or second, that Ms. Le Pen was going to be first or second, that both of them shall move to the second round runoff, and that probably Macron was going to win. Now you don't know. Mélenchon has come out of nowhere to almost tie them. Mr. Fillon has come along quite some way. He would be my preferred candidate. He fell off the edge of a cliff of his own making. But suddenly, the polls, instead of having 10-point disparities, are suddenly narrowed to 3-point disparities. You don't know who's going to win that election. You don't know who's going to go into the second round. And you don't know who's going to end up being the next French president. 2 weeks ago, you'd have said it's over. Now you can't say that. Confusion reigns.
How about Tom? He's headed to D.C. this weekend for the IMF spring meetings. What's your sense of how this new administration regards multilateral institutions like
they don't
that?
Regard
is there going to be some worry in Washington?
Yeah,
about
there's going to be plenty
US
of worry in Washington. I think you'll end up seeing this administration has no respect whatsoever for the IMF, and I wouldn't be surprised if we walk away, straighten our jackets, and say y'all can do what you want to do, but we have very little interest.
Let me ask you a question that'll ring your bell. Mr. Scaramucci just darkened the door, and he's, of course, talking his book, and he's talking the book of the administration. I get that. What do you sense living where you live somewhere? Where is he? Northeast of Chapel Hill, David Gura? I can't remember. But you know,
you cannot help yourself, can you?
You are away from the...
I've given him all these lines in advance.
You are away from the oddities of New England and New York and the other sanctuary cities. What is the support of our president among those that at the margins supported him but seem to be wavering? What do you sense about that?
I sense that the support is stronger now than it was then. And
really?
Yes, and it's really fascinating because the president has made 180-degree turns on a number of issues, and yet his supporters are admire him for having made those changes. So I think I think in Virginia, in North Carolina, in Ohio, where I have some expertise, I think the support levels are the support capabilities and levels are stronger now than they were then. Truly.
Do you predict that for the rest of this term? The trend is there.
The trend is there, but what is disconcerting to me is that he has the capability of switching on a dime, and he has done that many, many times. He may switch again. Confusion, as I like to say, breeds contempt. But right now, confusion is breeding support, which is unusual, and it may continue.
Have you played golf with the president? He's played with everyone else.
No, I have not played golf with the president, and my handicap has gone from 5 to 9 in the course of a year. I'm not playing nearly enough golf.
And I won't ask why. It's your hands, right?
I can't putt a lick. I can't putt a lick.
Well, I would suggest maybe it has to do with the politics you're writing about.
The putter.
Have you been right on any calls this week? Can we leave this positively?
Yes, I've been short of crude oil for the past week and a half. I was short of stocks until yesterday morning. For the first time in a long while, I'm actually buying soybeans because I think you're starting to see a bottom there, but not a dramatic one.
Well, congratulations. Ringing the bell of the New York Stock Exchange today, Mr. Dennis Gartman, who's given us great support any number of ways here. Why don't you bring in the administrator, please? The biggest problem with Small Business Administration is you want to call her secretary or, you know, senior executive chairman, vice president, some fancy title.
It's a cabinet job, but it's administrator.
We'll wrestle with the title administrator and see what we can do, Dave.
Linda McMahon joins us now, administrator of the Small Business Administration, joining us from our Bloomberg 99.1 studios in Washington, D.C. Administrator McMahon, great to have you here. Let's talk first about regulation. We hear a lot of conversation centering on what Dodd-Frank means for the big banks. You're not dealing with the big banks in particular. That's not your purview. How similar are the regulatory challenges between the big banks and the small businesses in this country?
Well, let me share with you what I know and what I have dealt with in speaking with a lot of the small businesses around the country. You know, heretofore, community banks were the ones who really provided the capital needed for startup companies. And the community banks were the ones who knew the people in town, you know, the local nail salon or the barbershop or the dry cleaners getting started on the corner. And often they were those banks that helped those entrepreneurs get started, even though they might not have much of a track record. There was a little bit of guts on behalf of the community bankers. The new regulations tied their hands when doing that, and we've seen a lot of the community banks go out of business or being overtaken by the larger banks, and we've lost a lot of that ability in the communities to have small businesses have that access. So I think that's been one of the negative effects of some of the new regulations that have come in under Dodd-Frank.
I was talking with Cam Fine, the president of the Independent Community Bankers of America, a few weeks back. He was at the White House meeting with the president, along with some other community bankers, and he said he'd been offered some assurance that the president was very keen to appoint a community banker to the Federal Reserve to get that perspective out there. As you think about your role in this administration, how much of it is that, getting a bigger voice here for small businesses, be they community banks or smaller mom-and-pop businesses across this country?
Well, when President at that time-elect Trump asked me to serve, and I was very flattered to be asked to serve in this position, you know, one of the things that he and I talked about was absolutely being able to build back up, you know, our community bank so that we could serve our communities better. And I would hope to be able to offer any of the expertise that I have or any of the information that I garner when I'm out traveling and visiting throughout the 68 districts that SBA has its offices. I will be talking to lenders. We'll be having roundtable business discussions. We'll be listening to the community, and I want to bring all of that information back to the president.
Linda, you're one of the few people anywhere within the vicinity of Washington who's actually lived what you do. Down a small path in South Yarmouth, Massachusetts, was an ice rink. You probably served me a meatball sandwich a few years ago, but you and your husband how many years have you guys been married? What, 8, 9, 10 years?
How long have we been married?
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's been a while.
Well, I'll tell you, last August we celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, we were kids when we met. We've grown up together, and he is absolutely, truly my best friend in life.
General Mattis has done defense. You lived with Spades Small Business way before Connecticut, way before your huge television success. What do you need as a small business at the Cape Cod Coliseum in 2017? What do they need now when they go down that small road in South Yarmouth, Mass?
Well, that's no longer there, but I know. You're talking about clearly, you know, a comparable situation. And, you know, one of the things that we could really have used was access to capital. You know, when you don't have bricks and mortar to collateralize loans and you're dependent upon, you know, cash flow and you're just starting to build your cash flow, it's one of those things that you need cash to build cash flow, but you need cash flow to get cash.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I always advise small businesses once they're up and running, and I said, look, once you start to get good management of your cash flow, that's when you need to go in and ask for a credit line. Because when you need it, it's much harder to get. But build those relationships with your banks so that you can have more of a credit line to do your business, but you're going to have to be showing them your business plan.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.